The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 330 Premium for Thursday, May 12th, 2011. To the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab Premium, the show where, well, you know how it works. You send in the questions, you send in some tips. John and I research things. We provide the best answers we can. We also share our tips and we take it from there. We all learn something in the process. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, as usual, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
So,
yes.
Let's go right into it. This is good.
Get down to it.
Yeah, that's right. We're hot on this topic here because we were arguing about it in pre-show, so we might as well just dive right in.
Discussing it. We're not arguing yet. No, the argument will come.
That hasn't happened yet. That's right.
Or the difference of opinion.
George says, George writes, Steve Gibson talked about this in Security Now podcast 297. Essentially, Dropbox puts a plain text config.db file on Windows computers, and simply copying that file and putting it on another computer is all one needs to do to open Dropbox on that computer. Spotlight did not turn up a Dropbox file with exactly that name on my Mac, but there's plenty of stuff in the library folder that might be the equivalent. I also wasn't able to Google up where that file might be. So here's a Mac Geek Gab question. What and where is the Mac equivalent to the Windows Dropbox config.db file? And I'll throw in here the second part of his question, where he says Dropbox also, according to Steve Gibson, changed its terms of service to clarify that Dropbox can and will unencrypt user files, ostensibly for government, but as Google and the IRS have both learned to their chagrin, sometimes used by rogue employees just for the sake of curiosity. So, does this file exist on the Mac? Where is it? And then let's address this security thing from our standpoint, from our vantage points here, John. So you take the first part. Go.
The answer is yes, this file does exist, but it's cleverly hidden. Actually, I'll take that back. It's not clever at all.
Oh, that was a nice setup. I like that.
Well, somewhat clever. Well, I'll tell you what they did. So I did the same thing. Did a spotlight search for config.db and it didn't find the appropriate Dropbox file. I'm like, huh.
Well, okay. I'll stop you right there. Let's talk about spotlight and just remind our listeners, because I know you know this, John, and most of our listeners may know this too, but it's a good reminder for us all to remember that spotlight will not find system files or hidden files by default. And it can be changed to look for those. But by default, it does not look everywhere on your Mac. So with that in mind, you proceeded forward, I'm sure, John.
Right. So I actually did, after engaging a bit of Google Foo, I did find where it is. And where it is, so config.db does exist.
Okay.
And here's how I found it. Or here's where it is. You go to the terminal. So you're not going to see this in the Finder. So he's absolutely correct. You're not going to find it normally with Spotlight, or you're not going to see it unless you go to the terminal. Now, here's an initial tip. If you want to see where it is, or you want to see more than you normally see with
John,
the directory.
John, tell us where it is. You've got us on the fence. Go.
It's in a dot Dropbox directory.
Oh.
So if you go to terminal, which normally dumps you into your home directory.
Yeah.
And you then say cd space dot Dropbox. Now, what is this dot, you ask? And most people know. But if you don't know, in Unix, and that's why I'm saying it's somewhat cleverly hidden, in Unix, this means make the file invisible to a normal directory scan. And by extension, I would say it also makes it invisible to Spotlight, and that it's not going to show you files that are in invisible or hidden. I guess they're equivalent.
Yeah. I think that's, yeah. Very interesting.
But if you do that and you say cd space Dropbox, I'm doing that right now, and then you do an ls, you will see. Oh, well, look at that. There's Dropbox.db, Dropbox.
Are you in your dot Dropbox folder, John, or just your regular Dropbox folder?
Yes, and hold on.
Now, what's interesting is on this computer, I've done the same thing, and I don't have a config.db file in my .dropbox folder. I have a config.dbx file. And this is because Dropbox is already working to correct this problem. In fact, they have corrected it in their beta builds. And they released betas of 1.2 for the Mac, and I believe equivalent betas on the Windows side. You can get them from their website. These are publicly available. It does, of course, change the way that that database works, and there are some things that will not work because of it. Most notably is 1Password. If you've already got 1Password set up to sync with Dropbox, then it's fine, even if you upgrade. But once you upgrade, you cannot reconfigure 1Password to sync with Dropbox, at least at the moment. Of course, the 1Password people and the Dropbox people are actually working together on making sure that this functionality is restored by the time version 1.2 comes out of beta. So
now, this is strange, Dave, because as I was looking at this, and yeah, I was taken aback.
Yep.
Which I'm normally not, but in this case, I was. No, I looked on my Mini, and on my Mini, in the .dropbox directory, there is no config.db file. However, on my MacBook Pro, in the .dropbox directory, there is that file.
I wonder why it's not there on your Mini. That's odd.
Well, it's funny because now I'm highlighting, and for those that use Dropbox, if you go to the Dropbox icon in your menu bar and you hover over it, it will tell you the version of it.
Okay.
Now, what's even more unusual is that the version of Dropbox on my Mini is 0.7.110.
Oh, you haven't even gone to the one build yet. You got to do that.
And the version on my machine where I found that file is 1.0.28.
So I think 1.1.10 or 1.1.13 is the current build for Dropbox for Mac. And it is important, I think, to have all of your Macs, especially if you're doing local syncing, on the same version of Dropbox. Otherwise, it will work until it doesn't. And you can run into some problems with that. So,
right. I mean, yeah. That's good advice, but, and you and I talked about this before about
1.1.31. Sorry about that. 1.1.31.
Right.
You know, Dropbox has auto updating because
they claim
exactly.
you pointed me to the article. It says they'll roll them out slowly. Now, yeah. Unless I don't know how they define slowly, but just looking. Now, maybe 0.7
is incapable
of auto update. So that's why I'm still stuck at that version. I'm going to have to update it on the Mini. So,
yeah. So you may want to move to the 1.2 betas, although you know that on this computer here, I was having Dropbox issues, perhaps because of the fact that I'm running 1.2 betas, but they seem to have resolved themselves. All right. So the second part of George's. So other than moving to 1.2 for Dropbox, there is no other way to secure that file. The second part of George's question, though, about Dropbox's terms of service, where they say that they can and will unencrypt user files. Now, George presumed that this was for the government. That would be one reason. You know, let's talk about this a little bit, John. You have some thoughts about this.
Lots of thoughts.
Okay. Go.
You want now?
Yeah.
Well, here's my assumption. So looking over the security section of their site, they say that, well, yeah, you know, your files are secure. They're when they're on our servers, they are encrypted with, I don't know if they said AES 128 or 256, but they said that the files are encrypted with, you know, AES is one of the latest and most powerful encryption schemes.
Right.
Now, my assumption, which I believe now, I just made an assumption because this is how I would design it, having worked on secure systems.
Okay.
Now, the encryption algorithm requires a key.
Right.
All right.
Something to unlock it. Just like we talked about in, I think, in the last show about how the key is the thing that actually gives you access to your data. So, yeah, it would stand to reason you need that.
Right. Now, one could assume, and I think this is an incorrect assumption, that your key is maybe not your password, but at least based on your password. Without going too deep, I mean,
okay,
a lot of systems, what they do is rather than storing your password, which I believe older Unix systems actually did in a text file, which is the wrong way to do it.
Right.
They would take your key and put it through what's known as a hash function and actually add what they call salt, a little extra random info, so that your password is never stored anywhere. And if it's not stored anywhere, that's a good thing. Well, right. What I can take away from what they're saying is that your password is not the sole key that can be used to decrypt the data on their servers, or even worse, which was our pre-show discussion, they may be using a totally different value, which in my opinion is a terrible way to design a system to have a, or
now are you sure it's a terrible way to design a system? I'm setting you up here.
In my opinion, if you have a single key that unlocks everything, yes, that's bad. It should be tied to the user.
Okay. So
that if I was designing a system where I would assure people that your data is protected by a password, I'd feel a lot better if I would feel a lot better if the encryption was based on data that was within my control and not theirs. So if they're using a key that they came up with and only they know to encrypt and decrypt the data, that makes me somewhat uncomfortable.
All right. So this is the premium show, which I don't know why I feel this way. I guess we could do this in the normal show too, but certainly in the premium show, we give ourselves a little bit more freedom to go deep on this stuff. And this is important. So I ran into a lot. I have a specific thing about Dropbox, but I want to get there. I ran into a lot of this and thought about this a lot very recently when I was testing all those different online backup services. And I keep meaning to incorporate that into a show here. And of course, we've had too many questions, but here's a little piece of that. I think I tested 5 different online backup services, maybe 6 if you include Dropbox. But you know, there's Carbonite and Backblaze and Mozy and all of those. And of course, they're all doing something similar, including Dropbox. They're taking data that you have on your computer and sending it up to a server. We'll use the term in the cloud, but that's hosted and owned by someone else. And for all of them, including Dropbox, the data is encrypted at your computer and then sent up so that it is not sent in the clear. And that's a good thing, right? You know, you don't want somebody sniffing through the packets that could get the data. So it's encrypted at your computer and sent up to Dropbox and stored there.
I believe they're using SSL to encrypt it. So I don't know if they're encrypting it on your computer.
Yeah, good
point. But the transport.
Right.
And I believe I found that in the, so yeah, so the connection to Dropbox from your computer to their servers is SSL encrypted. So yeah, so somebody watching your data, but I don't believe they pre-encrypt it.
That's a good point. Send it.
I believe they're using SSL to provide security on the network connection.
That's right. And in Dropbox's case, that's
true. What they say right here. I'm looking at their security section. So you go to Dropbox.com, and you say transfer file data is over an encrypted channel SSL. Okay,
right.
Go.
Yeah, no, you're right. With Dropbox, that's true. And that's true in some ways for all the others out there. So your data is sent securely, and then in Dropbox's case, it's encrypted at their end and stored on their servers. Some of these, though, Mozy, in fact, all of them, Mozy, Backblaze, Backjack, and Carbonite, will allow you to decide whether or not you're using the common key, which would be accessible by the people at Mozy if they had to, or you can generate your own key, which is, John, what you just described, where you're the only person on the planet that knows that key. And without it, the data is not being unencrypted. And so if you lose your key, you're dead in the water. And to be fair, every one of these pieces of software, all these online backups, if you are using Mozy or Backblaze or any of the Carbonite, and you have not gone and changed this by default, you are using a key that is a common key that whichever company you're dealing with can use to decrypt your data. So to me, that's secure by policy, but not secure by technical reasons. But there are some good reasons. I talked to Gleb over at Backblaze. He says about 10% of their customers choose to use their own key. Now, whether that's because they don't know any better or they've actually actively made that choice is impossible to tell. But there are some reasons why you would want to use a key like Dropbox does, right? Where it's one common key. Obviously, if the feds come in and want to get at your data, or really anybody with a subpoena, right, wants to come in and get at your data, Dropbox has the ability to decrypt and provide that data for them. That can be a bad thing. However, Dropbox, like many other online backup packages, has an iOS app and or a web app, and you can get at your data that way. So if your computer dies, you can go to the web and pull down your data. Well, all of these things that have a choice, as soon as you choose to use your own password, can't get at the stuff with the iOS app, can't get at the stuff on the web, have to go through a computer that's going to be able to download and decrypt the data locally. The other thing, and you know, Dropbox, think about this for a second and it'll suddenly all make sense, John. You got, well, late, but you got the agenda for today's show, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I uploaded that. How did you get it? I sent it to you via our shared Dropbox folder. Mm-hmm. So I put that file into Dropbox on my computer. It went up to Dropbox's cloud and then synced back down to your computer because we have that folder set to do that. But you don't know my password and I don't know your password. So the only way that functionality could work is if that data is encrypted with a password that is common to all Dropbox accounts. Get where I'm going with this?
Yeah. No, I can see that, but
if I was to use Dropbox with my own encryption key, which you cannot, but if I were, there would be no way to share that data amongst other people.
Okay. So for sharing, yes, I'm with you, but so, for securing data that's specific to either me or you.
Yep.
I don't know if I'm crazy about that way of doing it.
No, I got to be honest with you. I'm not either. I've been using Backblaze at my Mac after the test and even during the tests for all of these. I set up my own key because I don't want my data stored on somebody else's server where they can get it. That's crazy.
And maybe what they do now, this is another thing. When I on the systems that I've worked on and designed.
Yep.
There's a fallback, and actually FileVault does this too, Dave. You can design a system so different keys, so not a single key is required. You could say, okay, maybe key A or key B. And depending on how you design the system, and we're not going to go with, you know, if you want to learn about this, then yeah, listen to Security Now or another security podcast.
Yeah. But
you can design a system where there's not just a single key that can unlock things. You can make it so, and actually I've worked on systems where you can have it almost like a launch code where you can say, okay, well, you need 3 of 5 pieces of information in order to do this operation.
Oh, interesting.
You know, kind of like with the missiles, you know, not any one person. In theory, as far as I know from watching movies, can launch a nuclear missile. You need at least 2 or 3 or whatever people.
Right.
So one person doesn't have too much power. And that's what concerns me about a system where there's a single key. Now, on the other hand, it's worked to our advantage, you know, for people that don't like things like DBD encryption.
Yep.
Because what happens is once you figure out the master key that's used to encrypt or decrypt all DVD or Blu-ray content, as we've seen, then they lose.
Right.
Because it's the same key in every device. So, but it's but I think they have a combination of policy and encryption technology, but it does make some question.
Well, it's good to know. And you know, when I did that talk down in Princeton, going through all this backup stuff, I did a slide on this because if you're going to be sending your data up, you want to know and make the choice. You may decide, look, it's worth it to me because of the convenience, or I don't care, or any, you know, number of those. It's the same conversation you always have with security.
Yep.
You're trading one level of, you know, you can either have high security or ultimate convenience. And then there are spots in the middle, but you will never have high security and ultimate convenience together. And that's
now I'm going to tell you, Dave, and then I wrapped it up.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just want to wrap it up with a final point here. And here's how you can stick it to the man. All right.
Okay.
Well, you don't necessarily have to store plain data on Dropbox or any of these cloud services.
Right.
You can store a file or a disk image that has a password that, yes, only you know. And right. in that case, all they're going to get if they're subpoenaed or whatever is an encrypted disk image or an encrypted file, in which case they would need the key that only you know.
That's so, right. Yeah. So you can really encrypt concerned. The data locally. You just have to do it manually.
Right. So there is a way if you're ultra paranoid, there is a way, even if, again, even if they do get a, you know, the person who wants to peruse the so-called encrypted data.
Yeah.
They're going to see your encrypted disk image and they won't know your password. So. Right.
All right. We've got two questions about the menu bar. So let's go from the depths of the system to the top of the system.
G'day, John. G'day, Dave. It's Andrew here in San Francisco. I need you to rescue me from Mac hell. Okay, so I've got an iMac 2006, the 24-inch white one, the Core 2 Duo, 2 gigs of memory. I'm running 10.6.7. My problem has to do with something called System UI Server. That's all one word. And what happens is whenever I plug my iPhone or my iPad into my Mac, the whole system goes into absolute lockdown. This System UI Server thingo goes up to taking anywhere between 80 to 90% of available memory, and it just causes everything to slow right down. Now, I know System UI Server has something to do with data going into the menu bar across the top right-hand corner of my Mac. Up there, I'm running World Clock Deluxe, Skype, Dropbox, Twitter, Smart Reporter, WeatherDoc, ChronoSync, Today, LogMeIn, Evernote, Stack Pro thing, Time Machine, and just the normal Apple stuff. The way I get around it is before plugging in the iPad or the iMac, I actually just put the activity monitor up, and as soon as I plug either in, the System UI Server comes up, goes berserk, and then I kill it and everything's okay. I can continue to use my Mac. If I forget to do that, I'm in for 10 to 15 minutes of pain. I've tried lots of solutions and lots of reading, but I just can't seem to answer it, and wondering if there's anything you can do to help. So thanks, guys. Here's where you cut me off.
And so we shall. All right. So you are correct that the System UI Server is the process that manages most of your menu bar. There are actually three sections to your menu bar. When you look at your menu bar, the easy section, of course, is the one on the left. That's what has all of your menus. And then there is the one on the right that has your username and the clock and some Apple widgets and perhaps some third-party widgets. And then there's one in the middle. And the one in the middle is not controlled by System UI Server. What it contains are icons from applications that you are running. Now, this seems like a subtle difference between the middle, what I'll call, and the right, especially since they're run right into each other. But something like Dropbox, the icon that you see in your menu bar for that is not managed by System UI Server. It is managed just by the application Dropbox that's running in the background all the time. Skype is that way too. I think he mentioned Twitter. That's another way. Well, other than simply knowing, how could you tell which is which? The rest of these, I'm not sure about World Clock, but I think Smart Reporter and certainly iStat Menus, those are all add-ons to the system that are running through System UI Server. So clearly you've got something in System UI Server running that is, you know, spiraling out of control when it sees the iDevice connected. But the first thing is you want to know what those things are. And then you can start systematically deactivating one by one by one. But deactivating Dropbox isn't going to help, nor is Skype, nor is Twitter, because those icons aren't coming through System UI Server. So that would be the wrong troubleshooting path. The way to tell is to go up to the icon, hold down the command key, and click on it. If a menu shows up, it's coming from an application. If it starts to float and you can move it around, and you can actually replace it or reposition things in the bar doing this, that's coming from System UI Server. So you can kind of float over each one, click a little bit and drag, and you'll be able to tell which things are coming from applications and which are coming through System UI Server. My guess for you, Andrew, is that it's probably your smart reporter or something else that has to do with the disk. When you plug in your iPod, the system sees it as another disk. Now, depending on the settings that you have, it may or may not show it as a disk in the Finder. The Finder may hide it, but the system does see it as a disk. So if you've got anything running in your menu bar that's monitoring the state of the disks, and Smart Reporter does that, then that may be the root of your problem. That's certainly where I would start. So that's my part on that, John. I know you, because we messed up with the agenda, you didn't hear the audio question until just now. So you've had some time to think while I've been chatting.
Yes, anything I have. Okay. Absolutely.
Good.
So one thing, I think this will be a good troubleshooting tip. So one thing that could help you identify what, if any, process may be causing this grief is you could go in Activity Monitor and you'll see a list of things. Like right now, I see System UI Server.
Right.
Well, that's nice. You know what? Let me double click on that. Oh, wow. Look at that. If you double click on it, you get another window. And then within that is a number of tabs, and there's open files and ports. And to reinforce what you said, Dave, all of the things that are under System UI Server will be in here. And I'm looking right now very quickly, and I see, for example, private frameworks / iPod.framework / okay, that looks suspicious. Maybe something in his system library is damaged. But there's a whole bunch of other things in here. So this will help you determine what processes are under System UI Server and pieces of software that you may want to consider deinstalling or deactivating or just keeping an eye on to see if they have anything to do with this problem.
Yeah, I like it. That's good. All right. So hopefully that gets Andrew down the right path there. Abdullah has a question, and this is an interesting one because we've been through this before. In fact, this is a follow-up to Abdullah from a recent episode. He was the one that wrote in that said he couldn't possibly get menu meters to be removed from his menu bar back in show 327. And he had uninstalled menu meters, and we walked through a couple of steps and thinking maybe he had the old 32-bit version and the 64-bit. He actually heard back from the author of menu meters. He sent in a support request. And the author said, yeah, based on what you're showing me, menu meters isn't installed. And for whatever reason, when he shared that with me, John, that's when I had the inspiration. Because we had listener Jeff quite a while back that went through pretty much exactly the same thing. And Jeff wrote, Intego, the makers of Virus Barrier, did a recent update within the past few months, and this mysterious menu bar item popped up for some users. Yes. This is my mysterious menu bar item. In preferences for Virus Barrier X6, click on the traffic tab. In the bottom section, there is a checkbox called Display Network Traffic in Menu Bar. I unchecked that and bam, the mysterious menu bar item was gone from my menu bar. And indeed, Abdullah has since written back and confirmed that this did it for him too. So for any of you running Intego Virus Barrier, be aware that it likely is putting some sort of network traffic monitor up there in your menu bar, and you can get rid of it in their preferences and in the traffic tab. It's interesting stuff, John. I like it when we can put answer from one listener with the other and meld it all together and make everybody happier.
Yeah, and while I'm thinking of it, I think Little Snitch will do this as well. I think if you enable it, Little Snitch will also put what could be confused as another program's network monitor.
Wow, that's because we don't like Little Snitch though, right, John?
You don't like Little Snitch. I love it. And it actually may apply to a question that we may cover.
Yeah, shortly. That's true. That's true. All right. Let's go to Jim and then we've got some tips to share, and then we'll probably jump back into some questions. But Jim writes, okay, I'm trying to help a friend out. He has a very big house. He's running an Airport Extreme as his base station and router. And we tried to extend his network using an Airport Express. No luck. The house is too big. Your recommendation was to use power line adapters, and we're ready to go in that direction. But I'm just not clear on how to make it happen and support a mixed environment of Windows and Mac devices. Do I buy a wireless power line adapter, or do I use a straight power line adapter and then plug a wireless router into that? I've been very remiss in solving this problem for my brother from another mother, so if you can get me going in the right direction, it would help me get this done for him. Okay. The best way to explain this, we've talked about power line before, but the best way to explain it is that you treat the power line adapters no differently than you would treat an Ethernet cable. From a relatively high level, you know, network topology standpoint, they are the same, assuming, of course, that they work. So perhaps an example will help here. You've got this big house, right? If you had your druthers, what you would do is run one big long Ethernet cable from the Airport Extreme out to wherever you want to put this Airport Express to extend the network in some far corner of the house. Of course, you don't have a big long Ethernet cable and you didn't put it in the walls. So what you do is you have power wires in the walls, and with the power line adapters, you can plug in and use the power adapter or the power cables in the walls as your Ethernet. And the way it works is you plug an Ethernet cable from the main router into a power line adapter. The power line adapter has Ethernet on one side and 3-pong power on the other. Then you plug another power line adapter in the far corner of the house, and you plug an Ethernet adapter into that and run that to your remote base station. And the base stations will have no idea that they are not directly connected with one Ethernet cable. Does that make sense, Sean? Did I explain that right?
I think so. So what you're trying to say is that I think all of these power line adapters will have an Ethernet connector.
That's right.
Okay. That's right. So it's a big virtual long. So at some point you're just, some of the cabling isn't Ethernet, but the network doesn't need, nor does it care.
It doesn't know, nor does it care. That's right.
Because these devices don't get IP addresses, do they?
No, they do not.
They're just trans. Okay, so they're operating at a very low physical level. It's just the transport is, or the technology or the medium is different. But they appear as a single big long cable. Yeah.
The way to describe this, and this is wrong, but implementation-wise, it works, is let's say you go out and you buy a switch, right, that has four plugs in it, right? You know, a hub is what we used to buy. A switch is what we would buy now. And it's got four Ethernet plugs, and you can plug four computers into those, or four devices. They don't all have to be computers. And everything plugged in sees everything else that's plugged in. Why? Because the switch has some wiring inside it that makes that work. Power line's the same thing. If you go get four power line adapters and plug them in different spots in your house, and that now you've got four Ethernet ports. So you plug four devices in, could be computers, could be not. All four of those devices will see each other. Why? Because there's some wiring behind the power line adapters. Different wiring than is in a switch, but it doesn't matter. The computers don't see it that way. So that's my second example. I think that's enough, right?
I'm with you. I'm going to have to try one of these one day.
Oh, it's awesome. It makes such a big difference.
Well, the only device, and this is why I'd like to do it, Dave, is the only device that I have in my house right now that is, could be wired, but is not, is the TiVo.
Right.
So all my network stuff is upstairs and the TiVo is downstairs. Right now I have a G adapter, wireless G. And the only bummer about that is that it drags down. It doesn't let me operate my time capsule or at full capability because it can't do all N. I have to do G. What I would like to do is instead plug into the Ethernet adapter on the TiVo and then make it essentially a hardwired device. And then I could ditch the wireless adapter and probably get better throughput. I don't know if the TiVo has 100 base T or gigabit. I assume 100 base T probably, but still it's better than the G adapter. So I'm thinking of doing that one day because then I can change the configuration of my wireless thing because it's the only G device. Everybody else is N.
Right. So you could go 5 gigahertz if you wanted on your wireless once you,
but the iPhone doesn't support.
Oh, that's right. The iPhone only supports N at 2.4 gigahertz. That's right. The iPad, that'll do 5.
Yeah, I don't want one of those.
Well, I'm still resisting. Need to get your iPhone online. So,
but I could eliminate G devices by doing that. So at least everybody could run N if I kicked the TiVo off and made it a power line adapter. So
that's right. That's right. Yeah, it's good. All right. Wes has a great little tip for us. Wes writes, guys, be aware that the Tinkertool app provides a GUI interface which allows one to easily rearrange the order of the login items for the active account. It's so good, in fact, Apple should steal it. So that speaks back to our conversation about the hokey pokey you have to do if you want to rearrange the login items order using Apple's system preference pane. But Tinkertool, and there's something else out there. Somebody else wrote in with something else, right, John? Or was it you that told me about there's something else too that'll do it? I know Tinkertool will, obviously. Thanks, Wes. But I think there was something else. Onyx might even be able to do it. But don't quote me on that. I know there's one.
I just say you man up and you just get in that login items, that plist file, and just manually rearrange them.
You have fun with that. The rest of you, Tinkertool.
Or woman up. Man up or woman up.
There you go.
We're equal opportunity here. So
you're just digging yourself deeper.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to get fist shakes from both sides.
From everybody now. That's right. Shake your fists at John. And if you wanted to shake your fist at John, you could email us at premium@macgeekgab.com.
No. Well, if you want to shake your fist at Dave, then you would write to premium@macgeekgab.com.
Or if you need to shake your fist at both of us, it's premium@macgeekgab.com. Of course, you can always call 206-666-GEEK, which John is
4335.
You can find us on Facebook now, facebook.com/macgeekgab. Right?
Yes. Yeah. That was amazing. Yeah, we just staked our claim to that. So thanks to everybody who saw that. And just because, you have to, I guess you got to prove to them that there are enough people interested in your.
Right.
Whatever you have to say. And obviously we.
I think our premium listeners are proof positive of that. But as is everybody else. I mean, we do appreciate your support. It's fantastic. So thank you.
You can write on our wall. We will permit you in this one case to write them.
That's right. Jeff shares something that actually is timely and good. So he found an article on Daring Firewall. I guess it turns out that it was Marco Arment, who is the author of Instapaper, said you should encrypt your backups, if not for security. And he's talking about your iOS backups. So when you connect your iPod up, assuming a system UI server doesn't spin out of control, a la Andrew, you can plug it in. And then when you click on it in iTunes, the first page you get is an info page. And there's a bunch of checkboxes, I think 5 or 6 of them at the bottom. One of them is encrypt backups of this device. And Marco Arment says, you should encrypt your backups, if not only for security reasons, but for a big convenience game. Encrypted backups will include your email and mobile me passwords, so you never need to re-enter them after a restore. This is huge, because this is reason enough to encrypt your iOS backups, especially if you wind up going from one iOS device to another. It's great to be able to restore a backup from your old iPhone to your new iPhone, or even to the same device, of course, and not then get stuck, 2 hours later saying, oh yeah, I need my email password for receiving mail. And then an hour after that, oh, I need my password for sending mail and, all that stuff. And then you find out mobile me is not syncing. Why? Well, there's no password. That's very cool. And I'm glad, I don't know how Marco figured that out. If it was by trial and error, that's great. If it was another method, that's even better, because we like all that good stuff. So maybe Marco will tell us how he figured it out.
Yeah. And of course, it guards against that temporary issue they had where there was location data being stored in that.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, John giving a nod to the latest iOS 4.3.3 and 4.2.8 updates that secure the data files that track your location or thereabouts.
Oh, don't even you start. Say, no, they don't.
No, I know they don't. But they track pretty darn close to your location.
it's cache data to make your user location experience more pleasant.
There was some interesting stuff that came out at that hearing. I was one of the people here at TMO who was watching and doing some of the live updates of the Senate hearing, where Senator Al Franken convened a bunch of people, including Apple's Bud Tribble, asking them about all of this stuff. And poor Bud, he's a nice guy. He actually sat in with us with the All-Star Band and played keyboards back in the USSR. That's right, a number of years ago. Nice guy. But, he's got to do his job. So, and they had some consultants there, too. And some of these people were saying, Apple's statement is great. It sounds like, Apple basically, you just echoed what Apple has said, that, look, this is not data about this particular user. It's cache data and this, that, and the other thing. Well, it tracks where you've been and saves it. It tracks which of those it has seen and saves it. Based on to make it faster to locate you with GPS, right? If you were to use just the one GPS radio or receiver in the iPhone, it might take 2 or 3 minutes to get your GPS fix. But by using this cache data, and what it does is it caches your a group of known Wi-Fi hotspots and cell towers in your vicinity, and remembers which of those it has seen most recently. And then when an app says, give me your location, it can get pretty good with just that. And it also turns on the GPS. And when that kicks in, it gets you a perhaps better location. But this one guy was saying that, unless you're talking about being out in rural, nowhere, the non GPS version of that location is usually within 100 feet of where you've actually been. And because it's remembering all the cell towers and flagging all the cell towers and Wi-Fi hotspots that you've seen, it's what Apple was storing was not intentionally your location, but made a pretty good path of where you were within about 100 feet. So.
Yeah. I got to say the other day when I was in Manhattan and I needed to get my bearings, this was frighteningly accurate.
Oh, it's awesome.
And the thing is, in that case, 100 feet is not sufficient.
Right. Well,
I needed to know I was on Fifth Avenue and not Sixth Avenue or 42nd or 40, whatever street. No, it got me. And as I started walking, it started, sometimes I would see it, I think, doing its thing.
Yep.
Is it would start moving in one direction and then maybe do a little correction and then get more accurate, because no doubt it was grabbing both the Wi-Fi and the GPS data.
Yep.
So, I think it's a great thing.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, it's great. But it is good.
If there's any issue, and then we'll get back to the show here, but would be apparently some law enforcement and communication companies will kind of play fast and loose with allowing them to track people using their device. To me, that's more of a concern than this, manufactured problem that doesn't exist.
Right. All right. Rick writes, I have installed a method back to the menu bar and transitioning to memory. I have installed a method to monitor, among other things, the memory usage on my Mac. When I boot up, the level is about 40% used. As I use my Mac, this goes up to about 80% used. I've purchased more memory, going from 6 gigs to 14 gigs. My question is, if I stop all my applications and try to get back to my boot up condition, this number does not go down very much. I monitor the top user of memory, but there is no clear hogger of memory. Any thoughts on what's going on? I know something about how Unix works and about virtual memory, but this does still not explain what I'm seeing. All right.
Let me ask you this, Dave.
Go ahead.
A setup here.
Go.
Which I think will frame the problem, but the thing is, Mac OS X, and I assume the utility was being used to view this, reports 4 different types of memory. And I think that's where the problem lies, perhaps.
Perhaps, yeah.
And then I'm looking here. So Activity Monitor, System Memory will show free, wired, active, and inactive.
Right.
And I think that's part of it. But just the setup is that this is how OS X through Activity Monitor classifies the different types of memory. And I think that may be where some of the confusion lies.
That's right.
And I'll hand it to you, because I think you're going to nail this.
Yeah. So he's looking at free memory, which is anything that's not wired, active, or inactive. What you're seeing, Rick, is perfectly normal. And in most cases, a good thing. The reason is, as you load apps, of course, the data required to make that app run is loaded from the hard drive and the program files and all that stuff into memory. When you quit an app, certain things that are in memory are immediately, made free and purged. In other words, emptied out, marked as free. But some will remain in the system's cache as inactive. And that's what that inactive session or a segment is called, or that's what that is. This is data that might be used again, either by that same app if you were to relaunch it, or perhaps by other apps, depending on what frameworks and stuff it was. And so the system says, hey, if we don't need this memory for anything else, there's no reason to free it. Why don't we just leave what's here there? We'll mark it. We know exactly what it is. And if something else or that same app asks for that again, hey, we don't have to load it from the disk. We're good to go. We've got it in RAM. We're ready to go. It's totally addressable. Perfect. And so that's what that inactive means. That said, if you launch something else and it needed that space, the system says, well, this is inactive. It's the first thing that's going to go. And so that's what's happening. It would be the system hogging up RAM, if you will, but only in a way that it's supposed to. Now, when you have a bunch of apps running, the one thing to remember is that free memory should never be below about 50 megabytes. If you see it dip below 50 megabytes, that's a good indicator. And there are others, but to me, that's a good indicator that, yeah, you've got more running than your system would normally be happy running. And if you do that regularly, well, then maybe you should add more RAM. So that's, but what you're seeing there is normal. You know, if free gets down to, you know, even 200 or 100, you're all right. If it starts dipping down much below 50, again, that's an indicator that you're probably overusing your RAM. So, and the system will deal with it. It just might get a little slower.
And the way the system deals with it, to wrap this up, I think, and here's my key that something's that you need more RAM, Dave.
Yeah.
Is when you see page outs,
right,
starting to increase or swap.
Right.
The swap, I think, is normal if you're starting to push the limits. I think swap is okay.
Some level of it, but not gigabytes and gigabytes worth.
No, that's bad.
Yeah.
I mean, right now I'm looking and I have zero on both. But when you start seeing page outs, that means the system is starting to write things to disk to make up for what it sees as a lack of free memory.
And this can all be found. iStat menu, which sits in your menu bar, will show you this data, but it can all be found in Activity Monitor at the bottom. If you click on system memory, it'll show you the four different types of memory and how much of each is used. And then it'll also show you some stuff about virtual memory, and page outs is one of those. And yeah, you want to watch that. If that number is high or increasing, you've got a problem. You don't have a problem. You just have too much RAM being used, which I think you'll make it, you know.
Yeah, you'll make it. And, you know, a handy tip here, which is not always obvious to all Mac users, but if you're not using an app, quit it. Because if you don't quit it, it's using memory. And the more apps that are using memory, the bigger chance you're going to have of starting to swap a page out. So
it's
something I try to do. I don't always do. You know, keep your eye on your dock or...
Yeah.
But it's something to keep in mind is, the less apps you have running, the better.
Yep.
Or apps with documents, you know, if you're not working on it anymore, you know, quit it.
Yep, that's right.
All right.
I think we can do Greg, but we've got two from Greg. So we'll do both of them. Well, we'll do both of them. So Greg writes, my virus barrier program has a program in it that does the same thing as Little Snitch, which is called anti-spyware. When I launched Yahoo Messenger, an image came up asking me something that John didn't share with Dave. What did it ask, John?
What?
When he says when he launched Yahoo Messenger, a screenshot came up.
Oh, it wasn't the original. So it's very similar to what comes up in Little Snitch. So it's a dialogue. Yep. Yeah, I'm going to, because I have a photograph. No, I don't. But it's a dialogue that says, this process is trying to get to this IP address.
Okay. So similar to Little Snitch, it's a something that's sitting there monitoring network activity of applications and warning you when it sees something that falls outside of some parameters that either you or the application has set. What Greg asks is, should I allow this behavior?
And well, let's get specific. So what happened is it said the process KSURL is trying to go to IP address, whatever the IP address was.
Right.
And this is something, and this is why I like, though I know you're not a Little Snitch fan, but I am, because especially after installing a software update, sometimes I will notice new processes come up. Now, sometimes it's fun because it may give you a hint as to new things that Apple or other vendors are trying to do over the network. Like, for example, after the App Store, I noticed that there were some new processes that were doing App Store type things. But for the most part, I'm disappointed with the App Store because, boy, it takes forever to start up and do updates. But to get to the topic at hand, so what is KSURL? And I'm going to tell you what KSURL is. And I sent him a link to it. KSURL is a piece of software from the Google folks, and it is an update engine. I don't know why it's called KSURL. Doesn't really flow too well, but that's what it is. And I sent him a link to a webpage that shows what it is. So that's number one. So this is a piece of software that will go out, phone home, and say, hey, is there a newer version of whatever software I'm trying to update? Then the second part, and this was the one that I thought was kind of fun, is that he gave an IP address. How do you know who an IP address belongs to, Dave? Well, there are two things you could do. So number one, he gave me the IP address, and I said, well, you know, let's do, now I'm going to be old school here. This is going to show, you know, how long I've been doing this sort of thing. But I thought, well, let's do an NS lookup.
Okay.
Of course, that's the old school way of, but NS lookup, given an IP address, should come up with a name, or given a name should come up with an IP address, right?
Well, it will come up with its reverse DNS entry, which may or may not even be set. It's not a rule that those have to be set. It'll come up with something, perhaps. It'll come up with its reverse DNS, which is not necessarily the person who owns it, but could be.
Yeah. So to me, it's a good first shot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you did an NS lookup on the IP address for MacObserver.com, you'd get a machine.backbeatmedia.com as its reverse. But that is not, Backbeat Media does not own that IP address. We lease it from our host, and our host is listed as the owner. So to find the owner,
there is a service, and this is one of the ones that I like.
Yep.
And it's called ARIN. And that is, I believe, American Registry of Internet Numbers .net.
Yep.
And if you go to them and you punch in an IP address, it will come back with the people that own the IP address. So this is a good way, especially, and I find this also good if you get email from a weird source and you can punch in either the name or the number, this will tell you where the heck they are. And you may find out that it's somebody halfway across the world that is, you know, trying to fake you out. But this IP address that he gave, which was a 173.194.whatever.whatever IP address,
yep,
came back to, well, not a big surprise, Google, because the KSURL tool is also from Google.
Ah, so it's some Google software trying to update itself?
Exactly.
Okay.
And he wrote back to us and said, thank you for this information. And I think what he did is he then allowed it to enable. And sure enough, it was what Chrome.
Oh, yep.
Being a piece of Google software, this is the mechanism that they use. Now, I don't know if it's sneaky, like some of the things we talked about in the past, where it kind of does it without your permission.
Right, right.
But he blocked it, and then I think he unblocked it, because what was happening is when he was trying to update Chrome would say server unavailable. And he's like, why doesn't this work? Well, it doesn't work because you blocked it.
dude, I'm gonna tell you another way, right? Because you went old school on me, right? You went to the first thing you did was NS lookup to find out the reverse DNS.
Well, I know there's another command for that, and that may be what you're going to tell me about.
It is. That's right. So you go to the terminal, you do NS lookup space and the IP address, and it'll do exactly what John described. instead of going to Aaron's website at aaron.net, A-R-I-N.net, you can simply type who is. And that's really what you're getting from ARAN. And in fact, when you do a who is, W-H-O-I-S space, and then the IP address, it will give you all the same information. And in most cases, it's actually going to get that from Aaron, but it'll spit it right out on the terminal. And who is a core part of Mac OS X, so it's installed on every machine you have. In fact, I think who is even exists on the iPhone. You just need to be jailbroken to, to do that. So that's what I do when I see an IP address. I just, who is the address? And 9 times out of 10. And then that way you actually get the owner of the address, not somebody that's, you know, perhaps leased it or whatever.
You know, it's funny though. So just for yucks here. So I did a quick who is from the command line on my mini.
Yep.
And here, so I think they're linked together, but I still think RN is a good authoritative source and they have a lot of other things there.
Yep.
But so I looked up an IP address that I know belongs to GTE because I used to manage a network that used GTE. And one thing I know is that one of their name servers is at 4.2.2.1. So I did a whois on that. But the funny thing is that part of the record that's returned by the command says ref colon HTTP colon slash slash whois.rn.net.
Right. That's right.
So I think RN is where a lot of people go at some level to get this information and then listed all the other stuff. But no, you bring up a good point that, yeah, it basically does boil down to a whois command.
Right. Yeah. Which is good stuff.
So I think he said, I forgot the conclusion. I think the conclusion was that, you know, he preferred to update it manually or just at least now he knows what gate he's controlling and what it's doing. So that's good news.
Right. All right. And then Greg had another question. He said, with my iPhone 4, I have one work and several personal emails. Every time I send an email from the personal account, it adds my work signature. I have to erase it every time I send a personal email. My guess is that you will say no and move on to the next question. Can I have individual signatures for each of my accounts? And the answer is no, unless you're willing to jailbreak your iPhone. And then you can buy Mail Enhancer from the Cydia store. I think it's about $1.99. It's not all that expensive. And it lets you do all this stuff and it'll even do it automated so that as you choose email addresses, it changes your signatures and all that. It's yet another one of those reasons that that you might want to jailbreak your iPhone. In fact, I didn't even think about this, John, but one of the guys at Backbeat Media yesterday asked me, you know, what's the benefits to jailbreaking? And so I listed 5 apps that I find are, and this will transition us perfectly into cool stuff found, but I have 5 apps that perform things that I desperately would miss if I did not have a jailbroken iPhone. Number one is an app called Xpander. And I've talked about that before. It's like Text Expander system wide on your iPhone, right? So you don't, you're not limited just to the apps that have integrated Text Expander explicitly, but I can use it in Mail. And that's awesome. There is one called Phone GV Extension. And this lets you use Google Voice for anything that you would normally use the phone. So, you know, when you tap on a number in Safari and it pops up call, well, you get another option that lets you choose to use your Google Voice number. So that's pretty cool. T-Lert for SMS messages lets you float your SMS messages over the top of any app. So you don't have to switch to the messages app to just reply quick or even mark a message red. These will just float right in over the top of whatever you're doing. And of course you can figure it. IntelliScreen is the last one. Lets me put my mail, calendar, and the weather all on my lock screen. So I don't even have to mess around with, you know, going in and going to each app. It's just all right there floating on top of my lock screen. I don't even have to unlock the phone if I don't want. So those are my 5, including Mail Enhancer. So it's good stuff. I think you should jailbreak your iPhone, John.
Nope.
It's not right. Why is it not right?
I trust Apple has made the right decision in choosing what functionality is put in my iPhone.
What have you done with the John Braun I used to know?
The thing is, it concerns me because I don't want to screw it up.
Because it's your phone. No, I get that. Yeah,
well, it's my phone, but also, all right, so I know these people are coming out with these jailbreaks.
Yes.
And I guess they're breaking some sort of encryption or whatever, but...
No, really what they're doing is they're just making it so that the iPhone can run unsigned apps.
Oh, all right.
That's all that it's doing. You know, we've talked about this on the Mac.
Are you sure?
No. No, I'm not sure because I'm not doing the jailbreak myself. I'm running Red Snow, which is one of the...
All right, but no, this is a good question, I think, because what's happening is you're changing something on the iPhone, right?
Yeah, that's right. Whether it changes the boot process.
Is it okay? So you may be introducing new firmware, perhaps?
No, it's the same firmware. I mean, I'm now running 4.3.3 from Apple, but there is a change that the jailbreak makes to the boot process. So that it can modify whatever bit it needs to modify so the iPhone lets it show and run unsigned apps.
All right. I guess my only concern is that you are introducing software whose origin or intent may not be entirely clear to you.
That's true. Absolutely. Yeah.
Potentially any jailbreak software could be doing in addition, and boy, this would be a great little social engineering thing, in addition to giving you something useful, maybe doing something sneaky without your knowledge.
That's right.
So,
no, it's true. The reason I trust it is because I'm trusting it. It's like, you know, mass vaccination, right? Their source code is freely available, and you can, you know, enough people have looked at it that it couldn't possibly be a conspiracy big enough to rope in everyone that's been willing to look at the code. So. I assume since no news has come out that there's some nefarious purpose behind it, I'm good.
Next thing you're going to tell me is that Facebook wasn't a CIA plot to get people to reveal things about themselves where they didn't even need to break any laws because people are doing it willingly. And you know that's a nice urban legend about...
I'm convinced that Facebook's a CIA plot.
Okay, good. All right, we're on the same page.
That's right.
and aliens, we'll leave that for the next podcast.
If you hear some crinkling, it's just my tinfoil hat. Don't worry. Everything's okay. I have not been corrupted.
Okay. But as of yet, I've not found a need. I'm at this point, although a cheapskate because I haven't really purchased many apps. I'm at this point happy with the functionality that I get with the apps that I have. And I'll have to create a list myself. I was unprepared.
Oh, that's all right. I wasn't really thinking that this, you know, this wasn't in the agenda, but. You know, came up. What is in the agenda is a couple of cool things found in the cool stuff found category. Allison, that being Allison Sheridan from the NozillaCast podcast at podfeet.com. She says, I've heard you talking about the merits of Omni Disk Sweeper being free, but how you like the graphical interface of Space Gremlin, but it's $5. Have you ever played with Disk Inventory 10 from DERLIEN.com, graphical and free? It even makes a poof noise in animation when you delete from the graphical view. But then again, I like it so much, I think I donated $20. It's not as fast as OmniDisk Sweeper, so I use that when I'm in a hurry. Cool. All right. Disk Inventory X or Disk Inventory 10, I guess, is probably how they prefer to call it. But good stuff.
I would say 10.
Yeah.
I've resisted the urge to correct people to call it Mac OS X.
Right. Right.
You know, I've gotten over that, but I think it's 10, I think, is the proper accepted pronunciation.
Yeah.
Though if you're in X Files or X rated or whatever, you may want to say X, but
yeah.
It is. No, it's good. I checked it out. It's the graphical is I like. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. No, it makes a difference. That's right. So Ed suggested, something that I'm surprised we haven't mentioned over the years, a tool called Geek Tool. And what this does, it's an interesting little thing. It allows you to do a lot of things, but the big one is you can show things on your desktop on your Mac, and you can have terminal sessions open on your desktop. You can have your calendar show on your desktop. This is stuff that just sort of floats in the background on your Mac. It's really, I've known people that have used it quite extensively. And in fact, we'll put a link in the show notes that shows a screenshot of actually it'll show a library of screenshots, because you know you can do things like you can actually pull up little web clippings. So if you have, you know, network monitors or whatever that are running or things that you watch on a regular basis, you can actually set those to pop up and just be part of your desktop. But it's a very live thing. If you want to see your console log constantly rolling by, you can have that on your desktop, you know, battery status, calendar, and all kinds of stuff. It's so configurable, it's hard to explain, but the screenshots do a pretty darn good job of
I'm looking at the page. Oh my, I think I'd be too distracted by all the eye candy.
Well, that's
a lot of it looks really nice.
That's kind of the thing, is there's it's just more data that is constantly pumping at you. Exactly.
You and I already have this problem.
I don't need any more distractions. Thank you. That's right.
And Twitter and Skype and email and the iPhone and the
right. Yeah. Exactly.
And now Facebook. I mean, yeah, there's just what's one more? Just totally overload you.
That's right. All right. And lastly, Nick writes, a great solution for easily opening links in new tabs using MacBook trackpads or the Magic Pad is Middle Click by Clem at clement.bef. Well, we'll put an ink in the put a link in the show notes. You can open a link in a new tab with a 3-finger tap or click. Might be a great solution for the person with that question way back in show 310, or simply a cool stuff found item. Indeed. I believe it's free. And it's cool. You know, it does exactly what he says. It allows you to add yet that little bit of functionality. So thanks very much, Nick. That's awesome. You got anything else, John, before we... before we wrap this one up?
You know, I think I do.
Uh-oh. I'll push the band out the window. Go. Yeah, go.
No, let me find it here, because it was from one of our, I believe, premium listeners. But let me see if I can find it.
Uh-oh. John's calling an audible, folks.
What's that?
You're calling an audible. I don't know. I don't know where you're going. It's good. Just go. Did you find it?
Hold on. I'm scrolling down here. System.
John F. Braun, ladies and gentlemen, right there, Fairfield, Connecticut.
What I was going to find here, but I couldn't find it. No, it was brought up to me by one of the folks that I interact with on Twitter. But it was a place where it stores all of the system icons, and it's in core services. And I'm just. Maybe it was core. I'll have more info later, but no, or I'll tweet it, or I'll put it on the Facebook page, you know. But no, it was a place, because he was posing a question, and I said, well, can you be more specific? And he's like, no, I found it. It's in this specific location. And it's basically the place in, and actually, well, just a little tip here, but System Library Core Services is a lot of stuff that makes Mac OS X so wonderful. And one of the things in here is a collection of icons.
I think it's System Library Core Services, is it in core types.bundle, and then you go into show package contents?
Maybe that was it. And then contents. No, it was, I think it was a regular. No, I think you're right. Okay. Yes. And then you look in resources, and within that is a whole bunch of .icns files. And I believe that is the source of many of the, that's where you get the system icons. So
cool.
If you're looking for those or they get corrupted, then yeah, I guess this would be a place to look to grab them.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah. So that's, if you click on your hard drive and then go to System and then Library and then Core Services, and then that's going to bring up a pretty big long list. Right click or control click on core types.bundle and choose show package contents. And then in there, you'll find a contents folder. Open that up. And then a resources folder. And this is where you will find 250 plus icon files. And if you just tap it with your mouse and hit the space bar, you can do the quick look preview of them all. And there's PowerBook icons. This is awesome.
This is where all of the, but if you double click, Dave, then that will open. It should default to opening it in preview.
Oh, it does.
Which will show you all of the individual because an icon file is somewhat complex in that it's not just one, it's multiple resolutions depending on what you're doing. So it has super huge, I think 128 by 128 or 256, or little tiny ones, depending on
there's 512 by 512s of some of them in here.
So if you ever wondered, and yeah, I mean, I'm looking here and actually they got some pretty specific.
Oh, yeah.
Look here, I see com.apple.imac-g4-7. So it has icons that are frighteningly specific for the type of computer that the Mac thinks it's connected to and stuff like that. I even see PowerMac G5. Look at that.
Wow.
So I thought that was so cool that he pointed this out to me. So yeah, when you see those icons, you're like, wow, that's really specific. This is why. So just one of those.
Hey, it doesn't have the PowerMac G3 in here.
Yeah, well,
it does have the mirrored drive door G4, though, which is interesting because Snow Leopard won't run on a mirrored drive door G4 or any non-Intel processor Mac. But very interesting. Huh? That's good stuff. I'm glad you brought that up. That's fun.
But as you point out, I'm looking here. Yeah, it's 265. Entries.
Yeah.
So it's pretty. So somebody is hard at work making all these cool looking icons for us.
That's Apple going the extra mile for you, John.
Yes, they do. So we already talked about how to reach us, Dave, at premium@macgeekgab.com. So I'm not going to mention it again.
No, I think we're good. We can thank Michael Johnston for converting this show, and I was going to say all, certainly very, very close to all of our episodes to AAC for you. CashFly, of course, provides the bandwidth. You want to tell them how to find us? You mentioned Twitter, John. So if you go to twitter.com/John F. Braun, you'll find John F. Braun. /Dave Hamilton is me. /MacGeekGab is the show. We answer questions there sometimes, too, so it's a fine way to interact with us. /MacObserver is, of course, MacObserver. And the man down in Memphis himself, Pilot Pete, is, of course, /PilotPete.
Oh, he's in Memphis?
Yeah, that's where his office is. So he's down there a bunch.
No.
Yeah. Okay. But he says he's going to be here on Monday.
What else are we talking about? Haven't mentioned it for iTunes comments. We always love them. Yeah.
That's good. All right. Let's keep moving. We'll be back on Monday with show 331, because that's how we roll. We add one. That's it. That's what we do. We add one. What do you guys do in your podcast? We add one. That's pretty good. One time we thought about adding two, but, we didn't want to get caught.